Hey, everybody. Welcome to the next episode of the Strand Tennis Center podcast, filled with tips, advice, tennis, not tennis, just life advice, too, whatever you need. Like it on YouTube. Share it on the podcast as well. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Strand Tennis Center podcast. We were lucky enough to have a guest, Jennifer Gelhaus. She has a podcast called Vita Tennis, which is very good. You should check it out. She also is a teaching pro, and I just wanted to get kind of the life of the teaching pro. She currently goes from Martha's Vineyard down to Tampa and does seasonal teaching. I'm always interested in the teaching side, the business side. She had been a director, and it was just a nice wide-ranging conversation about business, teaching, how do you feel secure as an employee or not, and kind of her teaching style. So hopefully you enjoy this podcast with Jennifer Gelhaus of Vita Tennis. Thanks. I'm just curious about people in general. So I figured Jennifer hosts a podcast called Vita Tennis, which you should listen to it, Santi. It's good. It's a good, it talks to you. It's just real world stuff about tennis, which is great. My question to you is off the bat is being a 16-year-old coming to the States, how do you adjust to that? And how do you, have no family with you, right? You had nobody with you, correct?
Correct. Yeah. I'm born and raised in Venezuela, came for college, you know. I was learning English already at home for many years. And so that part worked out. That part was an easy transition for me, thank goodness. You know, because a lot of people, at least at that time, weren't really thinking about the future and, like, you know, going to go play college tennis and learning English for some reason. I got really lucky on that side. So that made my life a lot easier. But yeah, I came by myself. I was 16. So a baby. Now I look at 16-year-olds and I'm like, what the heck was I doing? But, you know, at the time it was like just exciting. You know, I wanted to continue to play tennis. I didn't start playing tennis till I was 11 years old. So, you know, I started competing when I was maybe 14. So my junior, you know, career per se was very short. So I definitely wanted to continue, you know? So, I got so lucky, so fortunate and never looked back. You know, I've been here since, it's been a long time since I graduated from college.
So you go to Lincoln Memorial in Tennessee. How does that connection happened from Venezuela? Did one of your coaches there make this connection? Did you make it yourself?
No. So my senior year of high school, I kept hearing, you know, people going to the States to play tennis, and, you know, I learned about college tennis. It wasn't really on my radar until my last year of high school. And so I was like, I wonder if I'm good enough for that. Because first of all, I didn't know if my level would be good enough. I think a lot of the people that were coming, they were better than me. Like, you know, they've been playing since they were babies, since they were 4 years old, you know, and competing for a really long time. They were very strong players. They were going to like top universities, top D1s. So I was like, wasn't too sure if like my level would be good enough, but you know, I was decent. Like, I was playing international competitions. I had come to the U.S. to play Orange Bowl qualifiers. And at the time, there was a thing called Prince Cup. So I had come, you know, a couple times to the U.S. already to compete on an international level. But I still just kind of wasn't sure, you know. So I it was all word of mouth, just talking to people, learning what the process was. And this is going to really show my age. At the time, it was VHS tapes.
Yeah, sure.
So I had to send out VHS tapes of myself playing tennis. I picked, I don't know, maybe 10 schools that I thought, okay, you know, these are not like top programs. I think like my level will be good enough there. And they were still good schools, still good programs, right? But not like a top D1 program. I knew I wasn't going to get into that. So I reached out to some schools, sent my VHS tape, heard from a few, and then the school that I ended up going to, the coach, I could tell that he was really interested in me, and like right off the bat offered me a full scholarship, you know. So when you're an international student, a full scholarship is your love language, right?
Yeah, sure, it's like, yeah.
full ride, let's go. So I had no reason to say no. And, you know,
I'm even though it was. Go ahead. Finish. Go ahead. What were you saying there? I don't want to cut you off.
Oh, no. Even though that it was in, you know, in Tennessee, like in the middle, this is Lincoln Memorial University. Yet, like a lot of people don't know that school, you know, it's a D2 school. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere, you know, just outside Knoxville. It's a really nice school, turns out.
Okay.
And I had a great time. I wouldn't change it for the world. Like my team, all full of international players, great players. So I wouldn't change anything about it, but you know, someone from Venezuela, like here's, you know, middle of Tennessee, like you don't know what to expect, yeah, you know? Yeah. So it was just an exciting time. And I'm so glad that I did it.
I'll circle back. I'm asking a lot of questions about this because there's a lot of students here that have trouble wanting to communicate with coaches and stuff. And it's so easy now compared to then, right? You can just simply email them, text them. So I tell them it's just persistence and just do more. It's not a question of doing it 5 times, do it 30 times. You just keep going. My question is culture then. How do you adjust to tennis and your home in Venezuela to school? Is it a big adjustment in Tennessee going from obviously one culture to another? I mean, how, give me some differences that really stood out.
Yeah, I mean, the culture was very different. And even just the tennis culture was very different because at least where I was training, it was, you know, it was hardcore. Like I was training 2 hours a day, 1 hour of fitness during the school year. And then whenever we had a break, like in the summer or Christmas break, I was doing the same thing in the morning. I was, you know, playing 2-3 hours in the morning plus 2-3 hours in the afternoon. So it was a lot. And then when I came for college, everything kind of seemed easy. And school-wise, same thing. Everything seemed easier because I had been working so hard. And I don't know, maybe that doesn't sound too nice, but it's the truth. I mean, everything was kind of a breeze when I came here, maybe until my senior year when I had like really tough classes. I mean, I majored in biochemistry. So like my last year or maybe 2 years were tough academically, but like those those general requirements, they're so silly. Yeah.
Well, we don't have to, we can go on to school as a whole other thing that is just, school's too expensive and the ROI on it is not really worth what you're doing. If you can get a scholarship, that's great. But too many kids go to liberal arts schools. They pay $70,000 a year and they come out with a job that is just not returning the investment on that. We've got to figure the way to change all of that. But that's a whole other discussion we can go through. But I guess the culture of tennis and the language of tennis is the same no matter what, because we get students from all over the place, all over the world, over the country. You can communicate tennis-wise. You can kind of live anywhere because you're inside that culture of play.
For sure. And like I said, our team, we had a men's team too. And our guys and our girls, we're all from different countries. Lots of Europeans. I think I was the only South American, but they were all from Slovakia. Yeah. A couple guys from Czech Republic. So, yeah.
So one more question about that before we go into kind of the business of tennis I want to discuss. You major in biochemistry. Is it a tough question, you know? Immigrant coming in, tough change to tell your parents, listen, I majored in all this stuff, but listen, I want to go in a different direction. How is that conversation? How do you know, because most immigrant parents want their kids to have a better life than them, and they don't think teaching or whatever would be that better life. They want you to be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever. So I'm curious about that conversation.
Yeah, coaching tennis doesn't, and depending on the culture, right, doesn't tend to have like a good, I don't know what you want to call it, social status, or, you know, like it's not looked at with the respect probably that it should, because I disagree with that. Obviously, you know, this is a very specialized position. We bring a lot of value to people's lives. You know, I could go on and on and on about the value of a career in tennis. But yes, that was a difficult thing. I mean, I did go into research for 4 years. And two of those years I was coaching on the side. I was coaching college and I was doing, you know, I was working in a lab and doing both things. And then the recession happened and they let go of like almost everyone at my lab. I was working for Indiana University School of Medicine. They let go of a lot of people. And I was one of them because I was one of the most recent hires. So that kind of pushed me to really figure out, okay, what is it that you want to do? Do I want to continue down the research path? Do I want to fully commit to tennis? And I had to be honest with myself and realize that I have a lot more fun on a tennis court. It's what I really, really enjoy. And financially, it was like the same. I could be basically making the same, right? So, I talked to my sister, and then, you know, I talked to my mom, and she freaked out a little bit. Yeah, for sure. But, you know, she's over it now. But, you know, I think this is, and immigrants do kind of view the U.S. as the land of opportunity. Like, you can do anything you want here, you know, and parents from other countries don't necessarily see it that way. You know, it's like you're either a lawyer, a doctor, or an engineer or a dentist, right? And especially nowadays, like, there's so many different career paths that and jobs that didn't exist, you know, even when we went to college. So
I guess speaking from, you know, my wife and her, and we have a son and a daughter, it's the same thing. You want them to feel supported and that you know that, you know, they're going to be okay. But does you being married make her feel more comfortable, at least in that vein? Say, at least she has somebody in this country, blah, blah, blah. We're supporting each other. If you were on your own, would it be a more difficult decision, you think? Would she be more worried about you all the time? Or is that just a natural motherly instinct?
I wasn't married at the time when I made that decision. So I don't think that really played a role in that. Okay. It was more of just her own fears of, you know, what's going to happen to me, you know, your career, you had this path, and now you're doing a, you know, a complete change to a different, to a different thing, not knowing if that was going to be a successful thing. So yeah, I don't think that really played a role in it. Yeah.
So all these different coaching experiences, because I went through your bio, and there's a lot of different stops, right? And I'm just curious, coaching, did you like coaching Hillsborough the best? Did you like coaching a team the best? Do you like just teaching at a club? What did you like the most?
So I like it all. They all have its, you know, its great things and not so great things. I always say that, you know, coaching college, I really loved it. Like, I loved recruiting. I think the recruiting side was my favorite thing. Like, I love talking to people from all over the world and, you know, telling them about the school and Florida and, you know, what a great thing it would be for their future. Like, I really enjoyed that. And obviously the thing I loved the most was game day. Okay. Like, you know, match day, that's when it's on. Everything that we've put into practice, you know, it now goes into play. You know, that's what you live for as a tennis coach. So that was really fun, you know, to get that competitive environment. And, you know, that's really fun. But it got to a point where, one, I wasn't making any money from that job.
Yeah, it's
tough. So it was just, so financially, like, it didn't make any sense, right? And two, there was a lot of situations where I felt that my job depended on a bunch of 18-year-olds. And I never felt quite comfortable with that, you know, because, yeah, like, maybe they'll have your back, you know, and they'll respect you, but maybe not, you know. And there's a lot of dynamics, team dramas that I wasn't particularly fond of having to deal with, especially if I wasn't getting compensated well enough, you know. So I looked into I just made the decision that, you know, I enjoy also working at a club because I get to really make a difference. I get to introduce tennis to beginners, you know. I work with a lot of beginners, or, you know, 3-0s, 4-0s. So I can definitely make a big difference in their game, show them a love for tennis, and, like, kind of make them love tennis like I love tennis, I think. So make them as passionate as I am. So I really enjoy it, and you can make a lot more money working at a club.
Well,
so
that's just, well, we can go to the business side. That's just the lifeblood of tennis. You're mostly, it seems like everybody competes to the top, and you really shouldn't. They have this narrow top, like, you're all competing for somebody to play on the ATP Tour, the WTA Tour, and that's like 1% of 1%. Most people are just a 3-0 and a 4-0, and they just want to learn a bit, have a good time, get a little better, and that's most of the country. And the problem is everybody's so interested in the shiny object of somebody playing, even Division One, even professionally, and it gets, and everybody's fighting over like seven people. It doesn't make any sense when most people, if you look at it, it's a service business for people to better themselves, become better players, but become better humans too. So that's really what you're trying to do. That's really most of society. We're just trying to, you know, alleviate some of the stress during the day and maybe learn something along the way. I mean, most of us are not going to be, I mean, it's 1% to be a Division I athlete, let alone just become a professional player in anything. So, you've got that right, that it's, that's where, if we want to talk about the business of it, that's where the business is. We're up
and your career has to be sustainable, right? Like you can't just be struggling always. That's no fun for anybody.
Correct. I mean, up here in the Northeast, we're, you know, most people that are great at what they do are going to go to an academy or things like that. And everybody, some people up here try to still open academies that just cater to homeschooled kids, and it really doesn't work. It ends up just failing. Because if you're going to do that, you're going to leave the state of, you know, New Jersey or New York, because you're going to go somewhere where they have the facilities, whether it's IMG or you're going out to California, things like that. But so when you're down, you're in Tampa, you're back and forth now, Tampa to Martha's Vineyard. You're at Harbor Island. I'm always curious about that business wise. So you're working there, and this is why I'm always curious, because of employees and thinking about the business end. Do you, at the end of this, understand what's going on with the club? Do you feel like employees need to feel secure? They need to feel like, you know, this place is still going to stay open. Was the feeling that this place, after COVID, wasn't going to last? Or did the ownership make it sound like everything was fine in regards to...
You're familiar with what happened.
Yeah, Lifetime, the whole thing and all that stuff. Yeah, so I'm just curious about your end as an employee. Do you know this is going on, or are you insulated from that?
No, we literally were given a month.
Yeah.
We were told a month ahead of time that they were going to shut down. And which is, you know, it is what it is. You know, it's a business. And when you work for I call it a corporate environment, right? For a club, like any of the clubs, you know, Cliff Drysdale or Invited, or I don't know, I can't think of any names right now, but like, you know, those big ones. That's a very different environment. And very different compensation, I've noticed too, from like what you can be doing at a country club. So long story short, I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I don't think the director knew either. So
was there,
yeah, it was kind of a big shock.
Yeah, but no one was there even the membership? Usually memberships are so, they talk all the time.
There have been rumors for many years that the land was going to get sold and it was going to turn into something, but that you know goes in one ear at the other, because there were so many rumors throughout the years about it. Yeah. You know, so nobody ever like took it seriously until it was like, oh no, it's happening.
So as an employee, was the club busy, so you felt like this is not a big deal? Were they always busy and active?
Yeah, the club was busy.
Yeah. It's always an interesting story, because I'm always on the business end going, all right, does the employee feel secure? That's the biggest thing with employee. They have to feel safe. They have to feel like they have a future and somewhere to go. And I'm always curious to say, hey, all right, you're working somewhere for so long. No one knows what's going on. And then you're a month gone. To me, it seems like the ownership over there just got a better deal from Lifetime, which is a larger entity. And then they got a bigger lease deal. Everybody wants Apple or Amazon to come into their space and rent it out or lease it. And it's just more secure.
Yeah. Well, actually, they were gonna get rid of that facility, and then the community kind of fought for it, and someone in the community kind of worked out a deal where, you know, kind of somehow Lifetime got involved, but I don't think that was the plan.
Okay.
From the get-go. I don't know. I don't really know, but that from, you know, outside looking in, I think that that's kind of what happened. But I'm in a very particular situation, because I go to the Northeast in the summers, so Tampa is not really a snowbird place. It's a year-round place. Like, it's not seasonal at all, right? So it's kind of been difficult for me to find like a good place where like the director knows that I'm gonna be gone in the summer, and that happened to be my place where the director was. He knew, right, that
okay.
Come Memorial Day, I was out, and then, you know, see you in the fall. and he was okay with it. But a lot of places aren't. Cool. So, and I like living in Tampa. Tampa's different in Florida. It's younger, you know, it's not like just a bunch of gated, retirement communities, you know, it's
Tampa's
different.
Nice. I've been down there. I was down there last year. It's really surprisingly nice. A lot of, I mean, all new finance between ARCs, fun down there. There's a lot of young people down there. It reminds me of there's an area up in New York, which is basically another suburb of New York. It's called Hoboken, which is it's very similar to it. Very young, a lot of young urban professionals, a lot of people. It's vibrant. It is. It's a great town.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really fun. So I could move to, I could move to Naples. I could move to Palm Beach, or Miami, even though Miami's really competitive. But, to more of a seasonal place. But I just, I kind of settled here and I don't particularly want to move somewhere else. So, yeah, it's too bad that they're not there anymore.
Last question on that. Did you reach out to the people of Lifetime? Did anybody communicate with any of the old employees? Or I'm always curious about that. Did they?
If they approach us? Yeah, no. I mean, I don't think they've opened yet. At first it was, we're going to open in 2 months. Then it's going to open in 6 months. I knew based on, I've seen a Lifetime Fitness and they're nice.
Yeah.
And I was like, they're going to make this place look like a Lifetime. It's going to take a while.
Yeah.
So I knew for a fact that they were not going to be opening anytime soon. If that's going to be for real a Lifetime. So
what made you want to start a podcast? I'm always curious.
Yeah. So I always kind of, not always, but the last few years I've been listening to podcasts, really enjoy it. And I always thought it'd be really fun to create a podcast. And what's it going to be? Obviously tennis. And I wanted to create something where, coaches could share information, kind of like what we're doing now. Right. And then somebody else can listen to this and think, or maybe relate to my story or relate to someone else. Right. And just kind of find that connection, because I've done that with other podcasts that are not tennis related. But I would love to be able to do that with my podcast, which is called Vida Tennis. Right. So Vida means life in Spanish. So that's why it's called Vida Tennis. So it's like that tennis life. So I always say it's the podcast for those of us who eat, sleep, breathe tennis. So those of us that, our livelihood depends on tennis, like we're working, our life, revolves around tennis in every way that you can imagine. So, I think I just want a connection. I've always felt that people in the industry kind of keep things to themselves. Everything's very secretive.
Sure.
So I kind of wanted to break that a little bit. And I also felt that whenever I would see people giving talks in conferences or anything like that, it's always the same people. And great, they're fantastic, but I want to hear from different people that are in tennis, so I was like, well, if it's not there, I'm gonna make it myself. So
that's true. It's a good idea, because I go to the World Conference of the USTA, and the issue with the USTA is they don't really know what's going on the ground. I really think people running businesses and out there teaching or really know what's going on. The USTA actually, they would ask questions and they ask like, what do we need to do? And I'm like, you just got to get out there and figure out what's going on. To me, the USTA has so much money in insurance premiums. They should be fixing up tennis clubs around the country instead of, pickleball taking those tennis clubs because it's popular and private equity is getting into pickleball because they think it's worth money and people are building all these pickleball courts. The USTA should fund They should fund millions of dollars of fixing up old clubs. His clubs are still stuck in the 70s and 80s. They're very old, antiquated. They still write things on paper. They still really are not into the future. And you can update these things. And tennis will always be there. You got to be careful about these sports that are, we have pickleball too. I'm really agnostic what people like. But tennis, you're not going to get 30,000 people watching a pickleball match. I just don't think that's going to happen. Maybe that's just me. I think it's more of a participation sport. The barrier to entry is easy. It's easier to play. It's a very fun social sport. But when I watch something on TV, I want to see somebody do something that I can't do because it inspires me. I don't, when you watch Sam Querrey and these guys play pickleball now, it kind of neutralizes what they can do. So I'm not as impressed by watching it because he can't hit 120 mile an hour serve. So we have to really, really understand that tennis is a worldwide international sport that is, needs to be nurtured always, and I wish the USDA would do that, and that's why a show like yours is great for that, because you need people to discuss this, because you're right. A lot of these tennis things are not interesting enough. They're not engaging enough, and, you know, we need to do that with our sport. We need to do that with even the business of it, and show that you can run a very successful tennis business, even though the margins are tough, because it's a huge, huge space that you're in, especially if you're in the Northeast or something, some latitude where you need an indoor facility. So those things are good, and it's great that you're doing that. Do you?
And I also, sorry.
No, good.
I also want like young coaches, right, to hear other people talk and feel like, oh, this person gets me. Like that's what, you know, I've been through that. I can see that, you know, because I've felt lost in this career. Like, I don't know who to go to for certain things, you know, like, am I going to make it? Like, you know, this job can be very up and down, you know, 1 month you make a lot of money, the next one, not so much. Like here, if you get rain, like there's so many variables, it's very up and down. Right. The kind of programs that, places run, or like you were saying, you go to a club and now everything's done on paper, you know, and not, you know, they don't have like a system for it. So all these different things, right, that I think, you know, I just hope that people are listening, right, and they're of a certain age, maybe in their 20s and their 30s, now they're thinking of like how they can improve their club, make it better, and just, you know, help them also stay in this career path. I think, because I've questioned it myself many times, right? Well, if man, should I continue doing this? Should I really continue? Should I keep going? Right? And I think everybody goes through that. You know?
I think if you're a normal person, you have a self-awareness, you're going to go through that in general with any career you're on. You should have some sort of self-awareness to be like, and audit yourself and just, you know, it just creates stability to be able to do that, just to say, am I on the right path? Am I doing the right thing? So speaking of teaching, I have a couple teaching questions because I know you got to go, but I'll ask a few more business ones and we'll go into teaching. What was the difference for you being a director in Martha's Vineyard and being a professional? What were those challenges you had? I think you were there for 3 years at East Chop, you said? I think so.
Yeah. No, I love being a director, and I want to be a director again. It's just, you know, it's very difficult to find a director job at a high-end club, especially a seasonal club. And that's my goal, is to get to that again. I had to leave because of housing situations, and you know, the housing on Martha's Vineyard like triple after COVID. So it's been, it was crazy, right? So anyway, I ended up leaving, and you know, now I'm at a different club, really nice, called the Bow House. And yeah, I mean, as a director, what I really enjoy is being able to, like, all the off-court stuff. And it sounds weird because most tennis pros probably don't like it, doing all the admin stuff. I actually like it. I like doing the administrative work and not having to rely on, you know, how many hours you were on court that day, you know. So I like that. And I feel like I can make a bigger difference because now I'm touching more people's lives. I'm growing tennis in a different way. I'm also teaching staff. So it's just more responsibilities overall. And I really like that. I like to be the one running the show.
Okay, that's great. That's it's very rare. A lot of people don't like that. A lot of people just kind of, you know, whether they're B players, they just kind of want to do their shift and work, you know, have a beer. And that's fine, too. Everybody has a role. Everybody needs a different seat on the bus. But it's rare to find somebody that wants to run something and be able to say, all right, I'm going to lead this group. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. That's a hard quality to find. So that's great.
No, I love that. It doesn't have to be about me either. It's not like an ego thing, right? It's just like I just feel like I have so much more to give, right? Sure. Than you know, just being on court. And honestly, like, my body can't take it anymore. Like, being on the court, you know, on and on. And I don't know for how many more years I'll be able to teach, you know, 10 hours a day. Like,
yeah, you just,
I know that there's people that do it, trust me, but I know I'm not going to be that person.
No, your legs just keep your brain, your brain can work a lot longer than your legs. It's just the way life is. I mean, 10 hours on the court, it's not like, I mean, all these, I always tell everybody, all these other classes, you don't have to partake in it. Like, you have to hit most of the time when you're doing a lesson, unless you're, you know, luckily you get 400 group, but you're still involved. You're still hitting. It's not like a yoga instructor. You don't have to do the poses. You don't have to do the exercises. You just kind of go through it. You're in it. It's very hard on the body. It's very easy. And it's hard because if you do 10 hours, you have to be just as energetic as you were, because that person doesn't know you've done 10 hours. That's the 10th lesson. They don't care. They want you at 100%. And yeah. It's not, you cannot go up to them and go, oh, it's been 9 hours. I'm tired. They're just like, big deal. Like, you know, they want what they want. They want service. Is there any particular book or any type of information that you've gotten director wise that you feel has helped you? Have you taken in any information? Have you said, boy, this has really helped me in regards to service?
A book?
Yeah. Any book or any writing? Anything?
Not really books, more just, you know, people that I've worked with that I've really just studied how they do things, why they do it, you know, getting to work with unbelievable directors. I think that's been the best thing that has helped me the most, is just seeing how they do it. And maybe I don't agree with everything, right? But I definitely can learn a lot. And yeah, a tennis in this industry, a lot of it is hands-on experience. It's like you just have to do it and kind of learn on the way. Obviously, are there courses? Are there books? Yeah, I'm sure. I haven't really gone into that. Maybe I should. Mostly, you know, my learning comes mostly through, I guess, podcast. I listen to a lot of podcasts, but it's more like personal growth.
Sure.
And also like marketing strategies, things like that.
Sure.
But I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place.
No, that's
but
all right.
Yeah. Long answer or short answer to that is I don't have any recommendations.
You know, listen, like sales tactics are just doing, right? So you can read so many different books, but if you make 10 sales calls, and you figure out on the 10th call, I should have said this, this, and this. It's really, you learn by doing, right? I will give you one book, though, Jennifer. Right. I will give you one. There's a great book by Danny Meyer, who started Shake Shack, if you know who it is. Urban Hospitality Group. Mm-hmm. Shake Shack is the burger place. And it's called Setting the Table. It's a fantastic book about service and just how you treat the customer and listening, Undercovering Rocks, it's called, and just kind of understanding the person closest to the customer always wins. So if you can be as close to the customer as you can, you're going to create a bond and relationship that's beyond tennis that will always keep that lifetime value of the customer. But you're right. It's all about doing. The more actions you take, the more answers you get. We always say the answers and the actions, because you can analyze things, you can study them, but if you don't do them, you're not going to get any real world action. So it's all doing more.
Yeah. And I do learn a lot from podcasts. Like there are even taxes, like there's I follow a podcast probably for everything, every genre. So, you know, just you pop it up in the car on the way to work, and you just learn something new, and then you can look it up later. Now information's at our fingertips, right? Like you can learn how to do anything just by looking it up. Well, not anything, but most things that you might need in your life. Obviously not like medicine or anything like that, but any basic thing, right, that you need as a professional, and if you don't, hire somebody, right, that can do it better than you.
Sure. So we got a few minutes for you. So teaching wise, as a head coach, how was a practice for you? A lot of kids like to know how you ran a practice. And then teaching at a club wise, how do you deal with the 3-0s and 4-0s? What's your kind of concepts, teaching skills? Give me the head coaching kind of day for you as you were coaching your team.
Yeah, sure. I work a lot with kids too. And I'm very much about being able to rally. I really like getting people to rally like as soon as possible, even if, and I know like we're all really big in technique, but I feel like sometimes it can go a little bit overboard to the point where it's not enjoyable for the student. It's just too much. And this is just, you know, what I see, and this is my opinion, right? Like just too much drilling is kind of boring for the person. And I think that's why pickleball is, it takes over like that, because people can actually go and play the game right away. And I've always, you know, that I've been teaching tennis have that mentality of I want this person to feel what it's like to actually play tennis, even if they're not hitting everything correctly and with the best form. So it's a balance, right? Because obviously the more you work on your technique, the better you're going to be at rallying and playing long points. But I just think, yeah, I just think that it's really important to make it fun, to make it real. And when it comes to kids and adults too, but mostly with kids, I teach everything through competitions and games.
Okay.
Like I'm not going to be out there or drilling for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, unless it's a private lesson, like the kid like really wants that, you know, individual stuff, right? But in a group setting, it's all about the energy, the fun, the skills, obviously. But do you know what I mean? Am I making sense?
Yeah, yeah, no, you're making sense. So are you using pressureless balls then for the kids to rally? Because it's a lot. It's not as frustrating for them. They can rally more with a pressureless ball. Are you using a regular regulation ball?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Anything that will help them feel successful, right?
Okay.
And as they're rallying, you can still, or playing points or playing a game, as that's going on, you can also be in the back of their mind, like, hey, remember to do this, you know, sure. Remember to do that, like keep emphasizing the technical aspects, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But always through enjoyment. I think you learn through having fun. I think if you're not enjoying it, you might retain some information, but it's, you can't see it. Like, I don't know how to explain it.
There's a balance.
I hate.
What?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Like, you hate. Go ahead.
I hate don't like it. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
So,
what'd you say?
No, it's a fine balance because when you have young kids and they can't rally, you gotta drill them because they can't connect with the ball and then it's no fun. So that's the hard balance with teaching tennis because it's a harder sport. So we try to lean into them saying this is difficult and it's much more rewarding when you become successful at it because it is hard. And I think it's harder now teaching. I'm sure it is harder for you, Jennifer, that kids this day and age want instant gratification. They get things so quickly on their phone. They get so many things that they don't want to deal with the frustration. But that's what life is. It's frustrations. It's degrees of failure and then moving forward and taking a piece of success out of that and then taking a piece of success out of that. It's hard because you got to learn how to create small victories inside of this longer, difficult, lagging indicator of success. It's just going to – they're not going to be successful for a while because tennis is tough, but they have to have little enjoyments along the way, like you say, playing and doing some things inside that. But – that's the hard balance because tennis is not pickleball. It's hard, and it's hard to learn, and it's hard to play, and it is a fine balance between little micro wins and then macro success. So,
and you got to meet people where they're at too. Like, why, if you have, for example, a player that's doing one lesson a week, why does it have to be all technique, right?
Sure.
Like, how technical can we get with someone that does an hour a week and it's a beginner? You know
Correct.
What I mean? Like,
and they have to manage their own expectations because you get a lot of tennis players that play once a week and they want all these things. And I'm like, think about anything you do once a week. You're never going to be really good at it. It's just the way it is. You're going to be okay. You'll be better. But they want, like, I want power. I want to hit a serve. I want to be like, all of these things are not going to happen at once a week. And they have to manage their expectations too. The time delay between what you're offering them and what they're going to get is going to be a lot longer. And some people don't respect how difficult the sport is. And that's what's hard. It's our job to educate them to say once a week, okay, you'll get a little better, but you're not going to get what your expectations are. And that's just the way it is.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. You got to go though. You got like 1 minute. So Jennifer, I appreciate the time. I appreciate it. It was awesome. But listen, good luck with the podcast. Hope everything goes well and stay in touch on social media and congratulations.
Yeah.
And,
thank you. Absolutely. When does this come out?
I don't know, Santi. I don't know what we're gonna do. Maybe a couple weeks, 2 weeks. We'll let you know. I'll send it to you, and we'll put it on our social media channels too. Before we'll probably put it. We usually release it on a Friday. We'll probably post Wednesday before, Monday before that it's gonna be out. But we'll get you the date. He'll send it to you.
Yeah, sure. No rush. I just was curious.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, no. Thank you so much for the invitation and for having me. And same to you. You know, best of luck with the podcasting. You're doing the same thing I am. You know, we're connecting the tennis.
Yeah.
The tennis industry, the coaches. So I think it's awesome. You know, we got to keep it up.
Yeah. I'll talk to you. If you're ever up in the Northeast, should you come up, say hello? Because you're coming up to Nantucket, I'm sure, in the summertime. So let us know. Reach out.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll stay in touch. I'll send you a message later.
You got it.
Thank
I'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everybody. Hope you like the podcast. Please share it with your friends, anybody that you know, anybody that's into tennis, anybody that's into bettering themselves, share it.